Welcome to the Underwater Podcast, where we take a deep dive into the world of underwater portrait photography, cinematography, and everything in between. With me, your host, Brett Stanley. Welcome back to the Underwater Podcast. And this week, I'm talking with underwater photographer and high-definition video pioneer, Tom Campbell. We chat about how he got started in wildlife photography, his move to cinematography, and how high-definition video really opened some doors for him. Tom tells us about his stock libraries, selling his first photograph, and he explains how he kind of disappeared for a few years. All right, let's dive in. Tom, welcome to the Underwater Podcast.
Thank you very much, Brett. Pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you here, man. You travel quite a lot, so where are you at the moment?
Well, at the moment, we're sitting at our house in Prescott, Arizona, but we actually live on our boat, which is in Ventura, California right now.
Oh, okay. So are you just taking a break from the boat and heading out to Arizona?
Well, we had some business to take care of and things we had to do here. And actually, we went to Colorado first because we're in the process of building a mountain cabin home.
Oh, nice.
In Colorado.
Yeah.
And outside of Ridgeway, Colorado. And so to go there, it's a two-day trip. So we come here first, take care of a few things, and then carry on and go over to Colorado.
That's pretty awesome. So you've got this mountain sea kind of lifestyle.
Well, we've always liked the mountains, especially Beth. And, I've spent quite a bit of my life living around the mountains, but I've always been on the ocean. Ever since I came to California in 1960, when I came down to get into the military, I've been in California ever since, and I've been on the ocean the rest of my life.
That's amazing. So, and you were in the Navy as well?
No, I spent 6 years in a special forces unit in the Marine Corps called Force Recon Teams.
Right. Okay. So what do they do?
Well, it's the Marine Corps equivalent to the Navy SEALs. They basically do the same thing. They're quite clandestine about their business, and they don't advertise nor do they promote it. Yep. So you don't hear a lot about them. It's more similar to the Delta Force in the Army, where they don't talk about what they do. They just do it.
Right. So how did you find out about it?
As a young kid up in Alberta, Canada, where I lived, I was born on a farm in North Dakota. And of all places to be raised, how I ended up with the ocean the way I did is a big question mark. But for 5 years, I lived on a farm in North Dakota. My dad was in the Second World War. When he left the war, he got discharged in Washington State. So he moved the family to Washington State, where I lived until I was 15.
Yeah.
And I lived in a very poor neighborhood there, in a little rental house that we had. But I thought it was paradise because I could go fishing and hunting and into the woods or the Columbia River anytime I wanted to.
Yeah.
And it was very, very little restriction on kids then, just kind of rampantly ran free.
Right. Just and doing whatever you wanted.
Yeah, pretty much we could. I mean, it was very common for myself and my buddies to walk over the railroad tracks and jump a train because they would slow down to get into the mill. And they'd slow down enough that we could run alongside of them, jump in the boxcars and get a ride to the mill where we could fish on the port docks and swimming in the Columbia River.
Yep.
And go to the port docks and go on the ships, all that kind of stuff, whenever I wanted to. It was a great life.
Yeah, adventure.
It was. And when I was 15, my folks moved to Calgary, Alberta, Canada. And I didn't want to go. And I worked out something with my uncle that I could live with an uncle and stay in Longview, Washington, which is where I went to the ninth grade and for a year. And then I moved up to Canada.
And then, so how was it in Canada? I mean, that's still a long way from the ocean.
It is, and I lived in Calgary, Alberta, and I don't have great memories of the place because it was more of a city life. We still lived in a relatively bad neighborhood, and so there was a lot of gangs there, and a lot of the people didn't speak English.
Right.
And it was not a pleasant time, and I started the 10th grade there. And halfway through the 10th grade, I have to tell you this real quick. My teacher, I had a question that I didn't understand taking a math test. and I raised my hand to ask the teacher if he could help me answer a question. And I told him I didn't quite understand something and if he could help me answer a question. And he looked at me and very loudly to the whole class basically said, well, maybe you're not smart enough to do this.
Oh.
And for a, you know, for a 15, 16 year old kid, that was pretty shocking.
Yeah.
So to make a long story short, that was my last day of school.
Right.
When I walked out of that classroom, I never went back to school again. And when I went home, I told my mom, I said, look, I quit school today and I'm not going back. And you'd wonder what a mother would say to a kid that would say that. And surprisingly, what she said was, well, then you'll have to get a job.
Right.
So, in fact, I did. I was quite mechanically inclined at the time, and I started working at various mechanical things with cars and so forth. And
yeah.
Ended up apprenticing as a mechanic in a shop that I did quite well at. It was a great job. I liked it. And I made money and I could afford to buy things. And it didn't bother me that I wasn't going back to school.
Yeah.
So essentially, that led into the first dive class that came to Calgary, Alberta. It was a sporting goods shop that bought minimal gear. And they advertised the first diving class. And I went to the shop to look at it just for the fun because I'd been reading a lot of things about the Navy's underwater demolition teams. And that seemed like a pretty exciting life. And actually, it's what I was thinking about in the back of my mind. So when I went and rented a tank with my buddy and a regulator, and that's all we had. And the instruction we got in the beginning was, don't hold your breath. And when the tank's empty, you'll have to pull this valve on the side to get 15 more minutes of air.
Oh.
That was the instruction we had.
Right.
We drove to the Bow River. And no swim gear, just swimsuits. And it was cold. We put this gear on and we clambered down over the side of the rocks and went down to about 15 feet. And I remember thinking, how could these people like Lloyd Bridges from Sea Hunt and Jacques Cousteau do this underwater when the pain was so extreme in my ears?
Right.
And it made me wonder how they could do that. But I saw a couple of old tires and a couple of little fish. And as stupid as it might sound, I was hooked.
Yeah, right.
And so I went back to the dive shop. We were not able to get the regulators off the tanks. And as a mechanic, I always had a toolbox in my trunk of my old car. And I just got my vice grips out and tried to twist the wing nut off the tank. And it was just bending.
Right.
Took it back to the shop and told them that I wasn't able to get the regulators off. He said, oh, yeah, I forgot to tell you. You need to suck the air out of the regulator first.
Right.
And take the pressure out of the tank. Then you can do it. Of course, he made it look quite simple.
Right.
It was a short time after that that the class started, the regular dive class. And I think it was a 25-hour class. And it went over the basics of scuba diving. And that was the first class in Calgary, Alberta that was taught. And I went through that. And it was a group called the Calgary Aqua Bronx. And so, once again, I was like totally hooked on this diving thing. So I spent the next 2 years apprenticing as a mechanic in the shop. And every spare minute that I had and dollar that I had, myself and my buddy traveled all over Alberta, British Columbia, diving in lakes, quarries, rivers, wherever there was water.
Right.
We logged 200 dives in 2 years. And if you've ever been to Calgary, Alberta, the weather sucks.
Yeah.
They have beautiful summers that last about 2 or 3 months. And the rest of the time, it's freezing cold, either raining, snowing, slush, and the rest.
So were you in like a wetsuit or anything? Or
what? I did manage to get a wetsuit from the dive shop. It wasn't a form-fitting wetsuit by any means.
Yeah.
But it worked. But I was, 17, 18 years old, so the cold didn't bother me like now. I can't even imagine doing that.
Yeah, totally.
But I managed to do it then, and I had a whole bunch of pictures of stuff that we did doing that. And the album got lost in a feature film that we shot one time. They wanted to use some of the pictures. They took the album, and I never saw it again.
Oh, no.
So I really have no pictures of what we did the first 2 years in diving in Alberta. But what that did was lead up to the point where I decided I wanted to be a professional diver.
Right.
And do this underwater stuff. And I was 18 years old, almost 20 by the time I made the decision to leave the shop. So I sold my car, collected the money that I had, took my stuff, and I transitioned myself to Longview, Washington, where my cousin and I decided that we would go in the Navy together. So in his 59 Chevy, we took off from Longview, Washington. We made it as far as San Francisco, and we got up in the morning, sleeping in the car. We got up in the morning, and my cousin Doug said, "Tom, I can't do it. I can't leave my girlfriend. I'm too much in love with her." Her name was Julie.
Yeah.
And there used to be a popular song called Julie. And I said, "Doug, we've got this all planned. I mean, this is what we're going to do, man." He said, "I can't do it." So Doug jumped in his 59 El Camino and went back to Longview, and I hitchhiked to Santa Monica.
Oh, wow.
And that's where I found a place to stay. I rented a little room with a little old lady who was 90 in Hollywood. And fortunately, I met a guy. I took all my gear down to the beach at Laguna Beach, and I was sitting on the beach with all my gear, and I saw this old guy running down the beach, and I could see him running for about 45 minutes. And I thought, God, look at the shape this old guy's in. And when he came back on his run, he saw me sitting there with my tank and stuff, and he stopped and introduced himself and asked me if I was going to go diving. And I told him, I said, "Well, I'd like to, but I've never been in the ocean, and I'm worried about sharks.
Right.
And I'm afraid I'll get bit." And he laughed. And he introduced himself as a guy named Willard Sage, and it turned out he was a fairly popular actor in those days.
Yeah.
And so Willard was an avid scuba diver. And he said, "If you'd like to go diving in the ocean, I have a trip that I'm doing next weekend out to Catalina. And if you want to go, it costs $14, I think it was, which was a stretch for me." He said, "But I'll take you with me on that trip." I went to Catalina with him. And it was a trip of a lifetime.
Wow. Yeah.
There was 100 feet of visibility. The visibility was obscured just by the amount of fish.
Right. Yeah.
And so I was just blown away with that. And Willard was a true mentor. He answered a lot of questions that I had, and I had a lot. And I told him that I was getting ready to go into the Navy to become an underwater demolition diver. And he thought that was very cool, so he bragged about it a lot. And so he took me on a lot of dive trips that we did together, including diving along the coast and so forth.
Yeah. But that Catalina trip was your first ocean diving trip.
First ocean dive.
What a way to start.
It really was. And in those days, like I said, the visibility was obscured by the amount of fish.
That's insane.
And I'll never forget it, in the feeling of the salt water and the difference in buoyancy and so forth. But Willard was a key player in my diving career. So the point came where I was ready to go in the military. I was 20, and I went to the Navy recruiter and sat down, and I spent 6 months getting in shape. I ran every day. I swam. I did push-ups and pull-ups, and I got myself in really good physical condition because I knew that's what I'd have to be able to do in the Navy.
Yeah.
And so I went to the recruiter. And he was a little short, pudgy guy, nice guy, but I told him I was here to join the Navy and I want to go into UDT. And he looked at me very seriously and he said, "Are you an Olympic class swimmer?" And I thought about that. And I was on the swim team in high school, as far as I went in high school.
Yeah.
And I was a really good swimmer, a strong swimmer and a distant swimmer. And I said, "Well, no, I'm not an Olympic class swimmer, but I'm a really good swimmer. And I've been on the swim team in school, and I've been swimming ever since. And I've been a lifeguard and so on and so forth." And he said, "Then you'll never make it."
Oh, wow.
He said, "All of our underwater demolition guys are Olympic class swimmers." And I mean, he just killed my dream,
an
instant.
Yeah.
And he came back with a comment. He says, "But I can get you a job as a boatswain's mate or this or that or one thing or another." He came up with all these job classifications that I'd never even heard of. And I just sat there staring at him, wondering, what am I going to do with my life now? I'm finished.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to go back to Canada because I really didn't like Calgary, Alberta. It was too cold and all that other stuff. So I went home, back to my little room, and I met a guy, a friend, who was going in the Marine Corps. And he said he was going down to sign up and go in the Marine Corps, and he wanted me to go with him. And I said, "Well, I'll go with you, but don't try to talk to me about going in the Marine Corps because I have no interest. I didn't know anything about the Marine Corps, living in Canada and Washington. I never even heard of the Marine Corps, basically.
Did you just assume the Marine Corps was just land-based?
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
And so I had no interest. Well, I went with him. And as he promised, he never said a word about enlisting, and neither did the recruiter. But the recruiter was a really sharp-looking guy, and he had these big posters behind his desk on the wall. And one was these guys parachuting out of an airplane. The other was swimming out of a submarine underwater, mountain climbing, and in dress blues.
Yeah.
And of course, those are quite impressive posters.
Yeah.
And I saw these guys, and so just before we left, I asked a recruiter, I said, by the way, who are those people in the posters? And he went on to explain to me that was their most elite unit in the Marine Corps, that they were called Force Reconnaissance Teams. And he said, only 18% of the people that try out make it. And he says, there ain't no fat guys. It's very hard to get into this unit. But that's what they do. And I said, do they do a lot of diving? And he said, they spend most of their life in the water.
And you were like, challenge accepted.
It definitely got my attention. So I told him, I said, well, do you think somebody like me could get in that unit? And he just looked at me and he said, well, he pointed at the posters. He pointed at the posters and he says, those guys made it. He said, those Marines made it.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, then there's a shot for me.
Great.
So the rest of the story is pretty short. I signed up to go in the Marine Corps. And of course, day one and day two, when you get to boot camp, it's the biggest mistake you ever made in your life.
Yeah, right.
It was a horrible experience. And I thought to myself, that in the middle of the night after the first day, I thought, what have I done?
Right. You know,
I really screwed this up. But so I went through boot camp, and I did pretty well in boot camp. And when I got out of boot camp, I was sent to a reconnaissance battalion, which is similar to the Force Recon Teams, but it's like the difference between a Navy diver and a Navy SEAL. They do different jobs.
Right, yeah.
And so I spent the first year in Recon Battalion doing rubber boat work, a lot of swimming, submarine work, things like that. And I really liked it. But just down the street were these guys that were out running every day. And every time they went to the chow hall, they had to run. They had to run every place they went.
Yeah.
And they always ran in small groups. And they were, of course, the most elite. And that's what everybody said. Well, those are the Force Recon guys. And it's impossible to get in that company almost. So I put in to try out for Force Recon, and I made it.
Great.
And I spent the next 5 years in that company.
Yeah.
Traveling all over the world, blowing up things. A lot of submarine work, a tremendous amount of diving and parachute jumping and rock climbing and stuff like that. So I loved it. I was at home.
Yeah, this was your happy place, right? Like, this is what you'd been building up to.
It really was. I mean, the people that you work with are real special.
Yeah.
The competition is very intense, but once you're in the company, you're like a brotherhood.
Yeah, because you're then family and you're looking out for each other.
Yeah, yeah. It's not like that when you're training. Nobody's very friendly with you because they think you're going to be gone anyway.
Yeah, or they're trying to beat you to the spot that's coveted anyway.
Yeah, but once you get to that point, it's the best job in the Marine Corps. Not to mention the fact that you get paid extra money for parachuting, for diving, for demolition,
right,
and hazardous duty.
You get the danger money.
And I didn't drink, and I didn't smoke, and I didn't gamble. And so I saved up a lot of money. When I was in 1964, I walked into a Chevrolet dealership and paid cash for a brand new 64 Impala.
Oh, that must have felt amazing.
It was. It was, you know, I had a really great life, and I was happy. I went to Vietnam in one of the first groups, and because of the specialty that we had, I was assigned to a CIA operation called MACV SOG. And four of us went to Vietnam, and we were stationed on a small secret base that was run by the CIA. And we ran our operations out of there on highly classified boats called Nasties.
Oh, right.
So everything we did was basically from the ocean to the beach, back to the ocean, yep, back to the base.
Wow. That's quite full on, too. So how long were you there for?
The tours were 6 months each, and I did two tours. So I was there 64 and 65.
Right.
And it was very dangerous work. And like I said, highly classified. And so that was the only downside to the entire military career that I had, was that the war was ugly and nasty, and it never seems to go away from you all the way.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
But I had signed up to go back to Vietnam because I worked with a special team of highly trained Vietnamese commandos, and those people were under my command. And we were together all the time in everything that we did, and they were the best.
Right.
So I wanted to go back. I felt that I was obligated to go back and be with them during the war. And while I was away on leave, I got involved in a really bad motorcycle accident and had several bones broken and pretty much put me in the hospital for 7 months. And my time in the Marine Corps was up then, and where I was going to ship over and do another 4 years, I was afraid that I would not be able to make the standards to get back into Force Recon. And I didn't want to be in a regular Marine Corps.
Right.
So I got out.
Yeah. And so through any of this, were you thinking underwater photography or cinematography? Was it something that had sort of come into that process?
It's a good question. And yes, I was. I actually started when I was really young. My dad gave me, and I don't know if this had anything to do with me becoming a photographer, but my dad gave me a Brownie camera. And one of the pictures that I took was up in Alberta. It was a picture of a deer standing alongside of a lake, and the reflection in the lake was so sharp of the deer and the mountains in the background that it was a total accident picture, but it was really beautiful.
Yeah.
And all my friends that saw that picture, and especially the adults, said, "Oh, Tom, that's a beautiful picture. You should be a photographer."
Right.
And I have no idea if that had any bearing on what I ended up doing, but I did enjoy taking pictures, and I started taking a lot of pictures.
Yeah. So you had that visual language. You kind of knew how to use a camera and kind of how to sort of see through the camera's lens.
I think so. I think it's a vision that you see, and you start looking to see a bigger picture than what the picture is. You start looking at all aspects of it. And that to me probably got me a start. Then when I went into the Marine Corps, I bought what was called an Iconus camera.
Yeah. 35
and, it's a 35 millimeter camera. And I bought all the accessories for it, and I started taking pictures with that underwater. Oh, they were horrible pictures.
Right, yeah.
And I took quite a few of them.
Yeah.
But I really enjoyed doing that. And I kept that camera with me all the time. And even though we were forbidden to take photographs in Vietnam by the CIA, I had that camera with me, and I did take a few pictures occasionally. But I had to be very careful about it because I could have gotten serious trouble.
Yeah.
I think that probably was the beginning of my photographic career. And when I got out of the Marine Corps, I continued to take pictures, but I bought much better cameras. I moved into the Nikon series of cameras.
Right.
And started taking pictures.
So for me, when I kind of got into diving and sort of taking photos under the water, I kind of found that I enjoyed having something to do. Like I found that when I was diving and just sort of floating around, I wasn't as involved as when I sort of pulled a camera out and then started having tasks to do. Like, do you feel the same way?
I do. I agree with that. You sort of venture off into another space.
Yeah.
And you do. And it allows your brain to start taking different paths, I think. And you're absolutely right about that. It does take you to a different level. And being underwater is sort of a thrill in its own. And because it's an alien world and so different, you have to combine those two things, the photography and this alien world, and figure out how to make them work.
Yeah, and how to fit them together.
Yeah, and I by no means would consider myself a professional photographer at that point, because I still have slides, pictures that I've taken way back in the 60s.
Yeah.
And most of that stuff I would just throw it away now.
If you took that now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I did continue to improve, and I got more dedicated to what I was doing, more precise in what I was doing. And the switch happened in a very unusual moment. I had been to Bonaire. I went there several times years ago with a group to go diving, and I took a lot of pictures there. And again, they weren't very good pictures.
Right.
By today's standard, yeah. I probably wouldn't have kept any of them. But they asked me, it was my second trip there, and the people at the resort asked me if I would do a slideshow one night for all the guests. And I was very flattered that they would ask me to do that. And I said, sure, you know, I'd be happy to. So I picked out what I thought was all my best slides, mm-hmm. put them in a carousel, and they had a projector and all that stuff. And I did this slideshow. At the end of the slideshow, a guy came up to me and said, I really enjoyed that slideshow. And he said, I own a travel company, and I would like to buy a couple of those slides for my advertising brochures.
Oh, cool.
And magazine. And, you know, I was flabbergasted because the first thing he said is, how much do you sell your photographs for? I'd never sold a photograph in my life.
Yeah, that's right. How do you work that out?
I had no idea what they were worth,
yeah.
if anything. And I had to be very careful what I said. I didn't want to sound like an idiot or an amateur.
Yep.
So I told him, I think I said something like, well, what do you normally pay for images?
Right.
And he said, well, what I want is a front cover, a back cover, and a short piece inside. And he said, we normally pay $400 each for the covers.
Oh, wow.
I hardly knew what to say. The trip didn't cost $800.
Yeah.
And so I said, well, that would be fine. And he paid me $800 and change for three photographs.
That you'd already taken.
I had.
Yeah.
And my wife said to me, and a couple of my friends said, well, Tom, you should sell your photographs. They're really nice. And I just never thought about it.
Yeah.
So I sort of switched gears and went into a marketing mode, and kind of the rest is history. I've sold thousands and thousands of dollars of photographs over the years.
Yeah.
And on the high end, $20,000 for one image.
Mm-hmm.
When Beth first started, when we first met, she was working in the office, and the BBC called and wanted a particular shot that had been on a number of cover magazines. They wanted to buy it. And I was overseas working. And she called me and said that they had called and want this particular image of a diver swimming with a whale shark. And she said, how much should I ask for it? And I said, well, first you have to ask these questions. And I said, ask them what they're going to use the photograph for, and if there's a photo credit, and whether it's a marketing image or this or that, and just questions about what they're going to do with the image.
Yeah.
And I said, 9 times out of 10, they will tell you what they're going to do with it. And then the last question you're going to ask is, what is your budget?
Right.
And I said, 8 times out of 10, they'll tell you what the budget is. And I said, when they tell you that, you just let me know what they say. So she had the conversation with them. They told them that their budget was $18,000. And so when Beth called me back, she was thinking, you know, $300-$400,
right.
maybe $500.
Yeah.
She called me back and she said, well, here's what they said. And I said, and what did they say the budget was? And she said, well, they said the budget, the total budget was $18,000. And I said, then that's what you ask for the photograph.
Right. Yeah.
And she hardly knew what to say. And I said, you'll be surprised what happens. So when they called back, she said, Tom said he'd be willing to do this. No credit, photo credit is necessary because it was going to be billboards and things like that.
Yeah.
And she said $18,000 would be fine. They sent the check.
Nice.
And I was fortunate enough in my marketing abilities to realize that the market was not in dive magazines and things like that, which is where most people try to go with yeah. diving photographs. It was more about marketing and advertising. And so I tried to focus a lot of my attention on big marketing companies, and it paid off very nicely.
So would you then take photographs with them in mind in terms of what you would shoot and how you would shoot it?
Absolutely. And for example, whenever I would shoot something, if I liked the shot and I think it had a market value, I would always shoot it with a cover in mind. So I'd shoot a vertical.
Yep.
And I'd move the picture around so that there was space on the picture for writing. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, give it enough space.
You have to have a heading, and you have to have various titles inside the cover shots. So I would think about what the cover would look like, not any one particular magazine per se, but a magazine cover. So I would shoot a vertical, and I would shoot horizontals. And I always shot 4 pictures of each thing, and they were bracketed automatically in the camera. These were back in the manual camera days.
Yeah.
They were bracketed by a quarter stop. Boom, 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 boom. Got 4 pictures. Bracketed by a quarter stop over and under, you're bound to have something that's spot on.
And is this, so were you just out on sort of dive trips and you would just see something that you thought would work for a magazine, or would you purposely go out and kind of find stuff to shoot to sell?
That's a good question. And the answer is both.
Yeah.
Sometimes I would go out with a specific story, because I used to write some of the stories, and magazine in question. And other times, if I saw something that I thought really had some value for a magazine cover or an article, I'd shoot it both ways. And I actually had a person that worked in my office who labeled all the slides. And so we had a very good organized slide library that I could pull slides very quickly.
Right.
And I learned a lot of other tricks that really helped me sell things. For example, oftentimes you have what they call signature pictures, and they would sell over and over and over again. And that was the case with a lot of my photographs. But occasionally you'd have somebody who would ask for one of those signature pictures, but they only wanted one picture. And an example would be, they'd say, we're doing a whole article on sharks. So we want to buy a picture of your whale shark, basking shark, tiger shark, whatever it was. And we only have $250 in the budget for one picture.
Right.
And it was hardly worthwhile as a professional running an office and doing what I did to sell one photograph for $250.
Yeah.
Not that I didn't do that on occasion, I did. But what I would say is, well, if you're doing an article on sharks, you must have other shark pictures. And she said, well, we do. We have quite a few. And I said, well, here's what I will do. I won't sell this particular picture for $250, but I'll send you 20 pictures of different sharks in one sheet. And you look at those pictures, and if you find more than two or three, whatever I said, I'm willing to take $250 for them, but only if you buy more than three.
Right. Yeah.
And that worked several times.
So you're basically upselling them from one photo to three. Because they get
or
them
more.
In one place. Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember in one case, they were doing a story on sharks, and I sold like seven photographs instead of one.
Yeah.
And I only got $250 for them times seven.
Which makes it way more worthwhile.
Yeah. So I think the situation with still photographs, you had to have a bit of a marketing talent, and you had to look at the bigger picture as opposed to just wanting to see your pictures in light.
Yeah.
You know, just having a photograph in a magazine or on a billboard or something is not the end. You have to look at it from a business standpoint, and you've got to sell a lot of them if you're going to make money.
Yeah. Yeah. If this is going to make you survive and make you a living.
And I did very well. I sold a lot of photographs. And as a still photographer, you know, I certainly made more money, I think, than somebody who would have been hired as a photographer to do certain things and it was on a fixed payroll.
Yeah.
My income was pretty high. In fact, when I got out of the Marine Corps, I went back to college. I took the college GED test and passed. So I went to college and I got a degree in criminal law and business, and from being a high school dropout to a college degree.
Right.
And I wanted to go into law enforcement at the time with an end goal of going to the FBI.
Oh, okay.
So to go backwards just a little bit, I took the written test for LAPD, LASO, CHP, and Colton Police Department, because I was going to college in San Bernardino. I passed all the tests except the Colton Police Department, the smallest department of all. I failed their test, which was kind of a shocker to me.
Yeah.
And I never really figured out why, but I did.
Yeah.
And so I had my choice of where I wanted to go to work. I chose the California Highway Patrol because it had an outstanding reputation. They had the nicest looking uniforms, the fastest cars, and they paid the most money. And you could transfer anywhere in the state when you had seniority.
Oh, okay.
Well, to me, that made a lot of sense.
Yeah. And they had motorbikes.
They had those too. Although I never rode a bike.
Oh, you didn't?
I was always a car guy.
Oh, okay.
So my photographic career, much of it took place while I was working for the Highway Patrol.
So you're doing this on the weekends or?
Yep. And every trip I had a chance to go someplace, I went. And of course, I lived in Santa Barbara. So I was right off the Channel Islands.
Yeah.
And I had a boat. And I could go diving pretty much whenever I wanted to. And so I just started taking pictures, lots of them. And, you know, things improve over time. You get better at it. And so I really enjoyed the job with CHP because a lot of interesting things happened. I was able to save some lives. I liked helping people, which is what that job is all about. And I got a chance to work with President Reagan's private security team. And the Olympics and other things like that. So it was a great job. And instead of switching over to the FBI, like I had planned, I just kept putting it off and putting it off. And time kept passing to the point where it didn't make any sense to leave the Highway Patrol when I was so close to a 20-year career.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, I was doing very well as a photographer. I never took a penny of overtime money. I always took CTO, comp time, because that allowed me to have really long vacations and get lots of time off to go diving.
Yeah, which was probably more valuable for you.
It was. It turned out to work out quite nicely for me.
Yeah.
And so I did an awful lot of trips, and I started teaching dive classes early on because I was a dive instructor. I got certified as a dive instructor in 1967.
Yeah.
Through NAWI and also through CMOS, which is the European Dive Certification Agency.
Yeah.
And so for about 20 years, one of my side jobs to make more money was teaching dive classes. And I did that at Westmont College. And I also taught driver's training for a while, which was a horrible job just to make extra money.
Right.
But that sort of got me through my CHP career. And when I got to the point where I made as much money as a photographer and some cinematography work, I decided to leave the CHP early.
Right.
So I did.
Yeah. And then so that took you into the motion side of things, like filming and cinematography?
Well, it's a good question. And what started me in that direction was simply this. When the digital cameras came out, I saw that as a major blow to any professional photographer.
Right.
Because anybody could take a picture and then digitize it, Photoshop it. They could put the right sky in, move things around, put people where they weren't, put animals where they weren't.
Yeah.
And the biggest thing that really bothered me was that, you know, you go to all this trouble to capture things in life, and especially wild things and underwater stuff, to capture it and show what it really is like. And once the digital cameras came out, I knew that nobody for the rest of our lives would ever know what's real and what's not real.
Yeah.
And we don't.
No, it's very true. Yeah. And I think there's definitely a mindset of people these days of just assuming things aren't real.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, I've sat for hours and sometimes days trying to get one photograph of something.
Yeah.
And I look at things. I've actually seen a photograph that has a whale shark and a hippopotamus underwater in the same picture.
And is it real?
No, can't be real.
No.
Whale sharks don't live in the same water
yeah.
that hippopotamus do. But what's a 10-year-old kid supposed to think?
No, exactly. Yeah.
So that really bothered me. So I have to say, I've never owned a digital camera. That was the end of my photographic career. I switched to cinematography.
Right. So if you couldn't shoot film, you didn't want to shoot stills.
That's correct. I didn't.
Yeah. So then when you moved into cinematography, was that into film cameras or were you then shooting video?
No, I started with a film camera, a 16-millimeter film camera.
Yeah.
Actually, I started with an early model Hi8 type camera, motion camera.
Yeah.
And worked up a little ways from there. And I actually built a housing one time myself and put my expensive Canon camera in it. And it managed to make one dive before flooding. And that was the end of my cinematography career for a short while.
Right.
But then, the desire came back and I bought a 16-millimeter camera along with some of the smaller, cheaper video cameras. And I have to say, I didn't like video when it first came out. Mm-hmm. I didn't like the quality,
yeah.
But they came out with cameras. They were like the VX1000 Sony camera, which produced a pretty nice picture, but it was still a 4x3 picture. But I actually worked for a lot of production companies using that camera.
Oh, okay.
And then, of course, the Beta cameras came out, and I shot as much as I could with a Beta camera, but I always had to rent them. And then a friend of mine, his name is Richard Andrews, and he was the president of a company called VidFilm in Los Angeles, and they view and use a lot of films and store a lot of films. And I had taught Richard and his wife how to dive. And he called me one day and he said, "Tom, are you going to be shooting high definition?" And I said, "No, probably not. I don't know anything about it. And I just don't know anything about it."
Yeah.
He said, "It's the future. And I think you should come down to my studio and see something that George Lucas has shot for Star Wars, some other footage that had been shot on these new large format high definition cameras.
Wow. Yeah.
So I gathered up my close friend, who was my second cameraman on all the jobs that we did. And we went to LA. We sat in this beautiful studio and we looked on this big screen. We saw this stuff that George Lucas had shot in high def. I was blown away. I was absolutely mind-boggled by the picture. I remember seeing little drops of water on eyebrows and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
And I turned to Dennis and I said, oh, my God, can you believe this? I said, we have to do this. And Dennis said, I don't think so. It's going to cost a lot of money. So Richard, once again, reinforced the fact that he said, Tom, this is going to be the future. It's just not here yet. So I called the people I knew at National Geographic, Discovery, and BBC, who I'd worked with all of them, called them up and said, look, this exciting news. I'm going to switch over to high definition, and everything I shoot from now on will be in a 16:9 format. And all three companies said the same thing. It's never going to happen.
Right.
And especially Kenan Smart with Geographic, I just don't think it's going to happen, Tom. It's complicated, it's expensive, and we just don't see us going that way. And I kept thinking to myself, he has to be wrong. I mean, this format is so beautiful and the quality is so good. It was 1,080 lines of resolution compared to 200, 250.
Totally.
Astounding. So I made the decision on my own to switch to HD, and it was a huge step for me because it cost me every penny I owned. I sold one of my cars. I sold a bunch of stuff. I borrowed some money. The camera cost $103,000.
Oh, my God.
The housing was $69,000.
Yeah.
And that's a camera with no viewfinder, lens, or anything else. No batteries. So by the time I got finished, I had my whole life in this camera system, and it was worth $250,000.
Right.
And still, Geographic and Discovery said, you can send us footage, but you got to crop it down to 4x3.
Well, so that was a question I had. Was their reluctance more about the cropping than the definition?
No. They liked the quality, of course. Yeah. They just didn't like the idea that it was everybody would have to switch. All the machinery,
Right. Everything
would switch to a 16:9 format.
Yeah.
And that wasn't going to happen. Well, it took about a year and a half, and I was very fortunate that I got a job offer in Saudi Arabia. And these people called, and apparently their boss, who was a Saudi sheikh, and this is a fabulous story in my career, they had apparently seen one of my shark shows on Geographic.
Yeah.
And their boss, the Saudi sheikh, said, well, how come our pictures don't look like this? And of course, they were shooting much smaller format cameras. And quite truthfully, they didn't know anything about production work. So the boss said, why don't you find this person and have him come over here and teach you some things about shooting? Well, that actually happened. They made some phone calls.
Yeah.
And somebody in LA, who I never found out who it was, gave them my name. Then they called Stewart Coves in the Bahamas, where they do a lot of shark stuff,
Yep. And
said they were looking for this person to shoot sharks and teach them how to shoot sharks and stuff, because their boss was an avid shark diver. So what happened was the person that they talked to, their dive photographic instructor in the Bahamas, said, well, we hire a guy named Tom Campbell to come here once a year and teach a program about sharks and how to shoot them.
Oh, right.
Well, so they hit gold dust there and they got a hold of my number and they called the office and they offered me this job of going over to Saudi Arabia for 8 days to teach their crew how to shoot. Well, at the time, I wasn't too crazy about going to Saudi Arabia, but it was a good job.
Yeah.
And so for 8 days, they flew me over there, business class, and I sat down with a bunch of really nice guys, young guys. They were three Australian brothers, and they were really nice, young, talented, good divers. And they knew about as much about production work as the difference between a tractor trailer rig and a cutaway shot.
Right.
So obviously they were struggling to produce videos that were of any quality.
Yeah.
So for 8 days, I taught still photography and how to shoot video and how to do it right and how to edit it. But I did tell them, I said, I'm not going to take any pictures here. You're going to take all the pictures. I'm just going to tell you how to do it.
Right.
And we're going to pick all your selects and we're going to make a 2-minute video and you can show that to your boss and see what he thinks. Okay, the end of that story is after 8 days, I went back to the office in Santa Barbara, and I no sooner got in the office and the phone was ringing, and the person in charge of their marina and their diving had called me and said, the boss has seen the 2-minute video and he wants you to come back and work for us.
Right.
It was like 110 or 20 degrees when I was in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
And I never saw the client.
Yeah.
And I had no interest in going back there. And I told him, I said, well, I'm flattered that you had asked me to come back and work for you, but I'm not interested. And at the time, my career was really booming quite nicely. My phone rang a lot. I had a lot of jobs with different companies and things were going very well. And so I told him, I said, I'm just not interested. And I'll never forget what this person said. He said, you don't understand. No one ever says no to the boss.
Right.
And of course, I felt like thinking and saying, well, I do.
Yeah.
But I didn't say that.
Yeah.
And I said, well, you know, you have to understand that I'm a busy guy right now. I'm doing quite well in my field. And I just don't want to come over there and take a full-time job like that. Well, the end of that story is we started talking about money.
Right.
Okay. So Tom took the job. And off to Saudi Arabia. And I took my whole crew with me.
Yep.
And we continued to show them how to shoot. And we did a lot of the shooting ourselves then. And I met the client, who was Sheikh Abdul Musin. And he's a really special guy. I've never in my life, I've met very few people who are more concerned about the ocean and its inhabitants than Sheikh Abdul Musin was.
Right. Yep.
He just was really into diving and ocean life and protecting sharks and things. But the job required traveling all over the world and shooting private documentaries about Sheikh Abdul Musin and his adventures. And who got to see them? No one.
Oh,
except
right.
The King of Saudi Arabia,
yeah.
King of Jordan, his Sultan and Sheikh friends in all over the world. But they could never be shown on television, and I could never release anything.
That was the specification, because you couldn't.
That was the agreement that we made.
Right.
But the other agreement I made was I would own, because of that restriction, I could see where it was going to lock me up. So the other deal we made on a handshake was I would own all the footage that I shot, except everything that he was in,
yeah.
His toys, his airplanes, and you know, his helicopters and his ships and all of his things could never be shown, but I would own all the wildlife footage.
So you came out of that with some decent, with some good stock, like a good stock library.
Who can afford to travel all over the world and shoot all that stuff for free?
Totally.
So that worked out nicely for me, and it was a good arrangement, but I'll try to shorten this story a bit. But after 3 years, I was gone 8.5 months out of every year.
Right.
And after 3 years, my phone started to ring less and less. And I remember turning down a 5-week shoot with Geographic, four shoots with Wild Things, which is a production company I loved working with. And if it had anything to do with wildlife or underwater stuff, it was mine. And I shot it.
Yeah.
And they called 4 times. And every time I had to say, I can't do it, I'm busy, they stopped calling.
Right.
So did Geographic. So did a lot of other people. GRB, Discovery, people I had worked with for years stopped calling. So I could see my career was going to suffer immensely. And this happened about 3.5 years into my job with the Sheikh.
Yeah.
So I told the person that worked with the Sheikh, his right-hand man, I told him, look, we're going to have to tell the boss that I'm going to quit. And this is the last shoot that I'm going to do. And he told the boss, and the boss was very upset. And the boss came to me and he said, Tom, he said, why are you doing this? We're having a good time. We're traveling. We're shooting. You're doing what you like to do. And I explained to him, I said, you know, it's taken me 15 years to establish a worldwide reputation where I sell photographs all over the world to all kinds of different picture people. And I'm now doing a lot of cinematography work. I said, but my phone is stopping. The calls are starting to stop because I'm turning everybody down. I said, it's kind of like being a movie actor. You're famous as long as you're in the movies. But when you stop being in the movies, your name just disappears.
Yeah.
And phone stops ringing and I'm not making any money. And he was moved by that, I could tell. He said, okay. He said, I'd like you to come back to me to Jeddah on my private jet. And we'll meet. We'll meet in the boardroom on the jet and we'll talk about this. Yeah. Well, what are you going to say? So I said, sure. Okay. So my crew went back to the States and I went to Jeddah. The boardroom on this plane would just blow your mind.
Right.
Something, I mean, something like I've never seen or imagined.
Yeah.
But he came in and we had this meeting. The really beautiful young stewardess came up to me and said, Mr. Campbell, the boss would like to meet you in 10 minutes in the boardroom. I said, that's fine. And we did, we met. And what he offered was a retainer that, and it was basically his idea and my idea. I said, I just can't continue to go on like this. I'll lose all my work.
Yeah.
And I said, then it becomes about money. And so he said, well, what if I pay you a retainer and you don't have to take any other jobs?
All right. Yeah.
And I said, well, as long as I'm making the money that I can survive nicely, and I was making very good money, I said, that would be fine. He said, okay, then it's done. I'll have my lawyer draft up something for you. You sign it, and we'll continue to work together. So we did.
Yeah.
So for 10 and a half years, I worked for the Saudi Sheikh, traveling all over the world and shooting. That brings us back to the library. In the end, Kenan Smart called from Geographic. And this was after a year and a half of me shooting this stuff all over the world.
Yeah.
And he said, Tom, guess what? We're going to switch to high definition, large format. And he said, I think the BBC and Discovery and everybody else is going to follow suit.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, it's about time.
Right.
And he said, you know, I'm sure you have a lot of nice footage and we can continue to work with you. And I'm sure we can get a good deal. And I told him, you're right. I do have a lot of nice footage from all over the world, but I don't know about the good deal.
Right.
And that's how the whole deal went down. And so I started selling footage. It was going out the door so fast that, believe it or not, in the very beginning, we were the first company to shoot underwater large format. The only other person that did it was a guy named Wes Skiles, very well-known cinematographer, good friend of mine, and the only other person that invested $250,000 into a camera system. We were the only two people shooting.
And Wes is down in Florida, right, doing the cave diving and stuff.
Wes was in Florida, yeah, very well-known cave diver.
Yeah.
Really nice guy, and he and I were quite good friends. We actually did a number of things together, mostly presentations that we would do at film festivals.
Right.
They would have Wes and I as guest speakers.
Yep.
And he and I were the only two shooting this stuff. And so he was starting to sell footage. And because we were the first to get into this, we're the only ones that had footage.
Yeah.
And the footage was flying out the door so fast, we had to hire another person to keep up with the sales. And believe it or not, the beginning price for HD was $100 a second.
Wow.
And the more footage you bought, the cheaper it became.
Yeah.
So you can see where that went.
Yeah.
So suddenly I was doing quite well with the office, not to mention my job. And, you know, I guess I just have to say that after 10 and a half years, I'd had enough of bouncing all over the world, being gone 8.5 months out of the year. You can't have a life or a wife. You can't do anything but go to work.
Yeah.
I loved what I did. I really liked working for the Saudi Sheikh and the people I worked with over there. So it was a great gig. And it came to the point where I had a chance to sell the library. And the library was worth a lot of money. And I did that because the red cameras had just started to come on the scene.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, you know, I made this big switch to HD when nobody else would do it. And look how it worked out for me. And I thought this red camera could put HD out of business or at least slow it down.
Yeah.
And because the timing was right, and even back to my still photographs, when I stopped shooting stills, when the digital cameras came out, I had a chance to sell my still library and I sold it. And many of my friends said, how could you sell 35 years of hard work with all those beautiful images, just walk away from them? And all I can say is, I guess you turn into a money shooter. If you're a professional shooter, you shoot to make money and make a living.
Yeah.
So the library is worth what it's worth.
Yeah.
And I felt very strongly about the fact that the libraries would lose their value with digital images. And I was 100% right. In those days, there was another guy very well known who I worked with and was friends with. His name was Chris Newbert. And Chris Newbert and I were talking about this one day when the digital cameras first came out. And we were in Papua New Guinea, actually, and we were having this discussion. And we both said, you know what? I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to switch to digital because I think it's going to kill the industry. And Chris said, I think it will too. And he said, I think I'm finished. I'm going to do something else.
All right.
And I said, well, I'm going to switch to cinematography. I'm not going to shoot any more stills. And yeah. I haven't shot stills since that time.
Wow. Okay.
I've never owned a digital camera. Most of the pictures I take are with my cell phone.
Right. Yeah.
Or my Red camera now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. So jumping from high def, which is, you know, 1080, to then going to Red, which is, you know, 4, 6, 8K.
Yep.
Must have opened up a whole new kind of world of stock footage because it could be used for so many different things.
It did. It did exactly that. And you're right. It opened up a new world. And it kind of goes back to the question of marketing. You have to be a marketing person if you're a photographer or a cinematographer, because otherwise you're just going to take jobs from time to time.
Yep.
And you're never going to get rich doing that. And there's an end game. As the time comes when you're not going to do it anymore, which is where I'm at right now. I mean, I still shoot and I still own the camera equipment,
yep,
but I'm not taking assignments anymore. And because I don't have to.
Right. Yeah.
But, you know, you have to dwell into the marketing world and try to figure out where things will fit.
Yeah.
And then try to work your skills into that market so that you can make money with it. And those that do that do quite well. And those that don't, they may be doing what they love to do, but are they going to be able to, you know, become millionaires or multimillionaires? Not likely.
Yeah.
And it's not all about money. It's about doing what you really love to do, but it sure doesn't hurt to make the money.
Oh, not at all. And I think, you know, if you are doing what you love and it's paying your mortgage or it's paying your rent, you know, if you can survive doing what you love to do, that's a win.
It is. It's a win. I've had such a great career, and I've been able to help a lot of people along the way. I've enjoyed bringing on new people with us. We've done that frequently. Sometimes we get burned. Sometimes we do very well with it.
Yeah.
And I like helping other people, whether it's advice or being able to hire them from time to time to do what we did. Jorge Torres was an example of that. He's a young guy from Spain that I met on Ernie Brooks' Just Love boat with Brooks School of Photography. And he was just graduating from the school. He was a bit of an underdog in a way because he was from Spain, didn't speak English quite as good as everybody else, but I could tell he was very enthusiastic about what he did and trying to get into the photography world. And he took a picture of me at sunset or sunrise, one or the other, and had it framed and sent it to me, and he signed it and had it sent to me. And he told me that if I ever needed somebody to help, he would love to work with us. We already had a pretty locked-in team.
Yeah.
So, you know, I remembered him, and I remembered what he said and what he did, and I was impressed with that. So a few months went by, I don't know, maybe 6 months or so, and we had a spot where we could use an extra person that we didn't have a big budget for. So I called Jorge, and he came, and he worked with us, and we really liked him. He was a great guy to get along with. He was willing to do anything and could do everything.
Yeah.
And so then he disappeared for about 6 months. We stayed in touch a little bit, but I got a call from a producer who was doing a story on the Navy SEALs. And the producer told me that Jorge had been signed on to be the cinematographer and do this story.
Oh, wow.
And he said, this may sound a bit unusual, but Jorge has said that if we can get you involved, he thinks you could do even a better job because you came from this kind of a unit,
yeah,
when you were in the military, and he'd be willing to do the sound or lighting or assisting. Nobody does that,
right,
in this industry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nobody. And I was just blown away by that. And so we did that story on the Navy SEALs. It was a Discovery Channel story. I never forgot what Jorge did. I told Dennis, my right-hand camera guy, I said, we're going to hire him. Any job we can take him on, he's with us.
Yeah.
So he worked with us for 18 years.
Wow.
And just an outstanding, he's not only a good friend, he's a very talented guy.
Yeah.
And now he works for the BBC and a lot of big agencies like that because he was younger, where Dennis is kind of retired, and I'm kind of retired myself.
Yeah.
But although we're still diving quite a bit and taking pictures, I'm just not interested in taking assignment work.
But to have someone that with that much credibility, like Jorge, to do that, you know, and not kind of take that job for himself and maybe not do as well of a job of it, that's a great character trait.
Oh, who does that? Nobody.
Yeah. No. Jorge. Yeah.
Yep. So Jorge got a really high paying job out of that because we made really good money working for the Saudi Sheikh.
Yeah.
And we got top pay. It was not exorbitant. It was just top pay for cinematographers who used that kind of equipment and had that kind of background, which is
right. Pretty
good money.
Yeah. So what's happening for you now? You've kind of semi-retired, I guess, and you've got your motor yacht, your boat. What's your kind of routine like these days?
Well, the best part about it is that I'm doing exactly what I want to do and when I want to do it.
Right.
With no pressure.
Yeah.
You know, I've had a really good career. I've not just made a lot of money, but I've traveled all over the world. I've met some very interesting people, made a lot of friends, and the adventure has been incredible. And so I've always wanted to live on a boat, and we could afford to buy a boat like this, and they're quite pricey. And we still have a home in Prescott, and we're building a new mountain cabin home in Colorado, just outside of Ridgeway.
Yeah.
And so we'll keep this house and just rent it, along with a couple other rental houses that we have. But I still enjoy shooting and diving. And so we still do use our stock agencies a little bit, but they don't make the money that they used to because just like high definition, when it came in, it was real good money and moving fast. But it too started to wane and fade away as the red cameras came in.
Right.
And the same thing has happened with the red cameras. I'm telling you, everybody and their brother has a red camera.
Yeah.
And there's a gazillion miles of footage out there from a variety of people. And some of them are really good shooters. Some of them are just avid vacation shooters. But if they shoot one shot that's really worthwhile in their whole career, they can put that in a stock agency or they can sell it.
Yeah.
So you add all that up. And what it does, it kind of waters down the industry a bit. And so there's still going to be a few people who are going to make really good money as cinematographers, but there's so many people doing it that I just didn't see jumping into the realm of the whole thing with everybody else. And because we've already had our ride. So the last two films we did, one was just a year and a half ago, and we shot that. It was 16 days in Micronesia, Truk Lagoon. And it was a story about Truk Lagoon, which I've done a few of those with different agencies. But this particular production company happened to be close friends of ours. They're very talented people. They didn't have a budget to do the show, but they wanted to do it. So we said, as far as our part, we'll go there on our own nickel. Everything we shoot, you can have and help produce your show.
Yeah, right.
So that's what we did on the Truk Lagoon show. The next call I got was from an IMAX company that I'd been involved with over the years a little bit. And when they called, I was going to turn the job down because I'm just not interested in taking assignment work. Unless it's something really special for the environment or something that's, you know, I don't know, just going to help somebody somehow.
Yeah.
And when they called and said they were interested in hiring me to do this shoot, I almost said, well, I'm sorry, but I'm not taking any assignment work anymore, so I'm not interested. Fortunately, I didn't say that.
Right.
I said, well, what's the film about? And they said, it's about the Marine Corps.
Oh, perfect.
I said, I'm in.
Yeah.
So that was the last, that was an IMAX film.
Yeah.
And I was one of the shooters on that. And it's quite a nice film. It was shot for the Marine Corps Museum in Quantico, Virginia, where it's shown on a big screen there all the time.
Right.
So those are the last two professional shoots I've done, and it's kind of the end. I'm, you know, where I'm at now. So we just spend our time on the boat traveling.
Yeah.
We had a lot of stuff in mind. We were going to do white sharks, gray whales, blue whales, mantas, and a number of things in the Sea of Cortez, which is why we took the boat there. But then COVID hit. It just killed almost everything we did.
Yeah.
You know, I should have been saying, well, we made 75 dives during the 9 months that we were there. We made 10.
Oh, right.
So it really put the brakes on things. But we still had a good time on the boat, traveling and diving and doing what we like to do.
Yeah.
And we decided to bring the boat back, and we were going to go to Alaska in March, April with the boat and do some underwater and topside stuff up there. So that's kind of on a hold right now for two things. Number one, we're not quite sure where we are with the build in Colorado.
Yeah.
And that's going to take some of our time. And number two, COVID thing has still shut down much of Canada and some of the borders, and we don't know what's going to happen there.
Yeah. I mean, how does that work if you're on the boat? And forgive my ignorance, but I'm not a sail kind of person. When you're heading up to Canada, if you don't make landfall, are you still kind of governed by their border policies and stuff?
Yeah.
Right.
You are. Right now, I'm not even sure we could take the boat into Canada.
Right.
And there was a time that too long ago that for sure we could not, and everything was shut down. So all those things considered, it sort of put a big question mark in what we're going to do and how we're going to go about it. So we're going to continue to stay on the boat and dive the Channel Islands and do mm-hmm. stuff out here.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure. And Beth, I have to tell you, Beth is not only a highly skilled photographer, and she has been for many years. She was a professional photographer in Alaska for years and years. And she worked with the Park Service up there, and she's worked on a lot of these big commercial boats as a naturalist.
Yeah.
And photo instructor and things like that. So together we combine our skills, where I don't take stills anymore, but she does.
Right.
And I just do cinematography work.
So between the two of you, you've got it kind of covered.
We do. We can pretty much do anything we want to do. And it's kind of nice not having a timeline or any stress to worry about. We
just
do what we want to do when we want to do it. And if we change our mind.
Yeah. And if you sell some stock, you sell some stock. If you don't, you had a good time doing it.
And it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You don't need the money. And
that's
a pretty nice position to be in.
Yeah.
It took a long time to get here, but we got here. And, you know, I have to say, I would encourage anybody who wants to be a professional photographer or cinematographer, I would encourage them to follow their dream. But I would suggest that they look into the business very carefully and decide just where they want to fit into it. I've always told people that I think you should specialize. All the work that I've done for various companies over the years, I've never had somebody call me up and ask me to do a shoot on grizzly bears or spiders.
Right. Yeah.
But can I shoot grizzly bears and spiders? Of course I can, but it's not my specialty. All the jobs I've ever gotten have come from people looking for specialty people.
Yeah.
So if you get a reputation as doing something really well, you have a better shot at being employed than you do if you tell somebody you're a jack of all trades and you can shoot anything.
Because totally.
You can't. I tell you right now, if you want to shoot bears and you got to compete with the top bear people in the world, good luck.
Yeah, totally.
You know, and the same with underwater. If you think you want to do all this other stuff but do occasional underwater stuff, and you want to compete with the top underwater people, good luck.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's such specific skill sets. Like, it's not even about the taking of the photo or the shooting of the film. It's, you know, it's everything that goes with that in terms of holding yourself underwater and moving and, you know, all these techniques you've built up over, you know, 30, 40 years of doing this that makes you so good at what you do.
That's true. And I would just suggest that if it's what you want to do, if it's really what you want to do, pursue it, but look into it carefully. Don't jump in with both feet. Like I used to tell people, don't quit your real job just yet. I mean, I kept my job as a highway patrolman for 20 years. And although I could have quit earlier, there were other reasons I stayed. One, I really did like the job. I liked helping people. And two, I got medical benefits if I stayed 20 years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And that's a big thing in today's market because we don't have that in this country.
Yeah.
So there are other things that you need to look into, but I do suggest that people try to specialize and do exceptional work in the field that you choose to go into.
Yeah.
And always keep in mind that anytime you can help somebody else along the way, it's always a nice thing to do. And bad-mouthing somebody else's work doesn't make yours any better.
No.
So there's no reason to bad-mouth anybody else that does something in the same field. It just doesn't pay.
No, and I feel like people pay attention to the people who do bad-mouth, and it doesn't go down well. Like, it, you know, they pay attention to who says those things.
Yeah.
And it reflects badly on them.
It does. It's a shortcoming on them, because if you think that bad-mouthing somebody else will help your work or give you a better edge on things, it doesn't.
No, exactly.
And I remember reading something one time, a guy, he wrote about a housing, and Fibico made the best housing in the world at the time, but he had somebody design a housing for them. So he wrote this nice magazine article in a dive magazine, bad-mouthing the Fibico housing, which Wes Giles and I were the front runners in using those housings, and it was the best housing ever made.
Yeah.
For a lot of reasons. And so I wrote him a note back, and I said, you know, I complimented him on the work that he does and who he is and his reputation, but I said, you might want to just keep one thing in mind, that bad-mouthing Amphibico's housing will not make your housing any better. And he wrote back.
Right, yeah.
Surprisingly, he did.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
What did he say?
He appreciated my comments. He said, actually, yeah, I feel badly that I said that. And I said,
yeah,
because, you know, it's just like when you're talking to somebody, especially if you have an audience like you do, if you say something, once it comes out of your mouth, it's done.
Yeah,
you can't take it back, and people don't forget. So
yeah,
when you say something negative about somebody or somebody else's work, it's done.
Yeah.
You never take it back, and it doesn't help you.
I mean, no.
All you have to do is listen to the news nowadays. You can see that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think kind of like, you know, helping other people raise up, like lifting other people up and supporting them and that sort of attitude in the industry, I think is far more beneficial, and it plays way better for that person.
Oh, yeah.
Than denigrating someone else.
Yeah, you're right. I have to tell you, Jorge works all the time. He,
yeah,
his phone rings all the time. He can work as many days, weeks, or months out of the year as he wants to because he's so good. Dennis could do the same thing, except he's retired.
Right.
And one of the guys I told you about when we went to Saudi Arabia, one of the people in the crew over there is now a full-time employee of the BBC.
Yeah.
And there are several people that we have worked with over the past and spoken to and given advice to who are top-notch professionals in the field. And I'm happy that we could participate in some small way in helping them get where they did.
Yeah.
You know, because it's very rewarding to do that. And you can't own this job or this work yourself.
No. And people come in and they do it differently. They take a different approach to it. And, you know, and that's why things evolve. And that's why there is an industry, because, you know, there's so many different avenues you can take.
Yeah. And I think the people that are doing this now, especially in the marine wildlife field, they need to keep in mind that the oceans and the ocean inhabitants are in serious trouble. The same thing applies to all the animals on this planet. They're in serious trouble and beyond what most people can imagine. So anything that you can do to put emphasis on the environment, protecting it and preserving it in some way, is beneficial and makes you a more worthwhile person in your field.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more on that one. Well, Tom, this has been amazing. Thank you so much for sharing your life story and your career. There's so much that I've gotten from that. And as I say, as we're talking about it, it's great to be able to share these things, these lessons and things that you've learned, and to the people listening and who might be up and coming in this industry as well. So thank you so much.
Well, listen, Brett, it's been a real pleasure. I've enjoyed very much in talking with you and learning what you're doing with your pod. I think it's great, and it's certainly beneficial to a lot of people. And I wish there were more people like you doing this kind of thing, because it also helps other people in their careers and helps them get ideas about how to start, where to start, and when to start, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I love about doing this is kind of giving all these different opinions and different kind of approaches to things. So thanks, Tom. Thanks for listening, everyone. And as always, if you like the podcast, please subscribe, review, and share. If you'd like to support with the production of these episodes, you can purchase our very cool merchandise at theunderwaterpodcast.com. We've got branded coffee mugs, stickers, beer cozies, and posters featuring our amazing illustration and logo by Joe Hodenow. If you'd like to connect with us or learn more about our guests, you can reach us at theunderwaterpodcast.com or on Instagram. We also have a Facebook group where you can discuss the episodes and even get your questions answered by our guests. There's a link to it in the show notes. Also, don't forget about Waterproof Magazine, showcasing the best in underwater art. Read it online or purchase a print edition at waterproofmag.org. You can learn more about my underwater photography workshops and mentoring at brettstanley.com or Brett S. Photo on Instagram. The Underwater Podcast is presented and produced by me, Brett Stanley, and our music is Neo by Oh Boy. Keep creating, everyone. I'll see you in the water.